Good evening. It's good to be with you all again. Thank you for being here again tonight. I'm excited to continue our study of 1 Samuel, chapters 16 through 19 is our text for tonight. Hope some of you had a chance to look over some of those chapters. And as always, I would appreciate and greatly value your comments and questions. I've had so many good comments and questions during and after all of the studies, and I appreciate those so much. I encourage you to keep them coming. I'm learning from you, as hopefully you're learning a little something from me. But I hope that we're all ready to open our Bibles and open our hearts and hear what God has to say to us about his son Jesus as we can learn of him through the stories of Saul and David. So I've called this lesson, with my love for alliteration, Heart or Height? Spirit or spear? I almost put spirit or spear it, but I thought that was a little too much. I restrained myself. And some of these contrasts that we've been talking about in these lessons, last night the contrast was faith or formality, I believe. And these contrasts here, heart or height, spirit or spear, some of these are going to start to be embodied in the characters of Saul and David. Saul and David are going to represent two different ways of being king, two different ways of leading God's people, one in a direction that is ultimately not sustainable and one that is at least closer to the vision that God had for his people. But I do want to say, we were pretty hard on Saul last night, and with good reason. Chapter 13, 14, and 15, Saul makes a lot of mistakes. But as I had some good conversations with you all last night after class, I thought it might be good to begin tonight's class with a review of reasons that we might have some sympathy for Saul. Now, I've come up with my own list here, and we'll look at it in just a second, but I would be interested in hearing from some of you for just a moment as we get started, based on what we've already studied, what are some possible reasons that we might have a little bit of sympathy for Saul? Anyone? Shannon?
He was thrust into the position of kingship, not by choice.
Okay, so he was thrust into the position of kingship and not by choice. You're kind of cheating because I was talking to you about this last night. So, but that was a good answer, though. You did. Great. Anything else?
There's no model to go before him.
Yeah, there's no model. He's the first one. He's the guinea pig, right? He doesn't have all this precedent of his father or grandfather or great-grandfather being king and learning from them, from their mistakes or their successes. Yeah, he's the first one. Good. Anything else? Yes?
It seems like he's receiving ambiguous instructions in terms of waiting at Gilgal 7 days, but he'd already been to Gilgal.
Right, right, right. Ambiguity in the instructions he was given from the prophet Samuel. Great. Anything else? John? Good. Good. I didn't even put that one up there. But yes, I mean, it's not as though it was a peacetime arrangement. The Philistines are all around. Great. Other reasons we might feel a little bit bad for Saul in spite of some of the mistakes he makes. Those are good. Those are some of the main ones I came up with. Let's just take a look at this list, and we'll come back to this at the end of class. We began this week of studies by looking at Eli, and I suggested then that there are some parallels, intentional parallels, between Eli and Samuel, both of whom are rejected from their office as priest and king, respectively, but who nonetheless remain sympathetic characters. Eli still has something to teach us. He had something to teach Samuel, and perhaps Saul is the same way. Saul, as Shannon suggested, was chosen, not self-chosen. He was out seeking donkeys. He wasn't seeking the crown, and it was thrust upon him. And we can debate this phrase. I think Shannon and I were talking about this as well last night. Samuel says, you know, you were little in your own eyes. And in fact, Saul says some things that sound like that. He said, I'm the least of, all the tribes of Israel, or Benjamin is the least of all the tribes of Israel. He initially avoided the spotlight. So again, not seeking this out necessarily. The details and timing of those instructions from Samuel were ambiguous, as we've already said. Initially, Saul shows some mercy to those who were mocking him or were detracting from his ability to rule. He doesn't put them to death when he had the right to, or perhaps the power to. Notice also that Just as Samuel might have been uneasy about Saul as someone taking his place, Saul might have been uneasy about Samuel and gone ahead and put him to death or exiled him or something so that this former leader couldn't interfere. But he respects Samuel. He listens to Samuel, and he cares about what Samuel thinks. And he doesn't kill the messenger when he's rejected. That's significant, because kings often did kill prophets. We read about that several times in Scripture, don't we? As we've already said, Saul was the guinea pig. He has no precedent to learn from. And this is an important point. We haven't really talked about this a whole lot, but going back to chapter 8, where Samuel talks about how much power the people are giving the king, that's a lot of power for one guy. And the power of the kingship could and would be corrupted for almost anyone, even a man after God's own heart, as we would see of David, especially in 2 Samuel. As good a person as David is, it corrupts him to some extent. And here's one we also don't need to overlook from chapter 8 and verse 9. Saul's failures are perhaps, in some measure, a punishment to Israel for their sinful requests. So Israel's sin plays into this as well as Saul's sins. And that's another difficult situation that Saul is put into, because God gives the people what they want, but that's not necessarily a good thing. And remember in chapter 8, verse 9, God said this is going to be a witness against them, that they asked for this. Okay, so I think all of these are reasons that we can have some sympathy, even as we hold Saul responsible for the choices that he makes. So again, we'll revisit this idea of having sympathy for Saul at the end of class. But let's go ahead and get into our text for tonight, beginning in 1 Samuel chapter 16. I invite you to follow along in your Bibles or on the screen. I'll be reading, as always, from the English Standard Version. Chapter 16 and verse 1. Remember how chapter 15 ended? Samuel has indicated that God's rejection of Saul, and it says that Saul and Samuel will no longer see each other until Saul's death, and Samuel continued to mourn or grieve over Saul. Even though Samuel didn't want the kingship around in the first place, he still grieves over Saul's rejection, and in fact seems to be a little put out with God about it. But then the Lord speaks to Samuel and says, "How long are you going to grieve? I still have work for you to do. I have chosen someone else to replace Saul, and I want you to go take your horn of oil, and I want you to go and anoint this man. He is the son of Jesse the Bethlehemite." All right. Now Samuel has some reservations about this. He even thinks that now Saul might kill the messenger, and so he asks God for help with this, and God arranges a less obvious reason for Samuel to go, to have a sacrifice at which there would have been a feast where the sacrificial portions would be given to Jesse and his family. And so Samuel is supposed to officiate the sacrifice. And so that's the ruse that the Lord gives Samuel to use so that Saul's suspicions would not be raised. So that's exactly what Samuel does. And now he gets to the true reason for his visit at the sacrifice, and that is to anoint one of the sons of Jesse. But God, interestingly, does not immediately tell Samuel who it is. He could have. He could have said, "Go to Jesse, and here is the name of the son that I want you to anoint." But he doesn't. He wants Samuel, I think, to figure this out. Or he wants at least Samuel to learn something. We hinted last time that just because Samuel is a prophet doesn't mean that he's all-knowing or infallible. That perhaps he even went a little too far in what he said about God in chapter 15. And we're going to see something similar here in chapter 16. Chapter 15 was largely about listening to the voice of the Lord versus listening to the voice of the people. That was that idea of listening or obeying the voice of the people was all over chapter 15. Chapter 16 here is going to be about seeing. How is it that people see? What are they looking at? And what should they be looking at? So hearing, chapter 15, seeing, chapter 16. Is Samuel going to be able to see the right thing? Well, when it comes time for Samuel to figure out which one of Jesse's sons is going to be the king, what does Samuel look for at first? What does he see? Okay, yeah, he sees the most impressive, handsome, big, young, strapping man, apparently Jesse's oldest, I think that's confirmed in chapter 17, Eliab, and says, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before him." So what criteria is Samuel using for who the anointed must be? What's that? Physical appearance, right? Physical characteristics. John?
Someone who looks like Saul.
Isn't that interesting? And in fact, I think we're going to see that connection between Eliab and Saul in just a moment in chapter 17. So that's a good connection to what happened way back when Saul, it said, was head and shoulders above the people. Is Samuel using the same criteria as the failed king that we've already seen? And the Lord speaks to Samuel about this. He says, don't look on the appearance or the height. Height and appearance are what the people liked about Saul at first. I've rejected him, for the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. So we have made explicit here something that was already said a little more indirectly in chapter 13. God is seeking a man after his own heart. And here in different words, that same thing is repeated. And so all the sons of Jesse are made to pass before Samuel. And God has rejected all of these, apparently. And so all the sons that are there have been observed by Samuel now. And Samuel says, it's none of these. And Samuel has to ask, are there any more? And in fact, there is one more, one who's keeping the sheep. One who apparently, when Jesse heard, the prophet wants your sons to show up, didn't even think it was worth inviting this one. But that's the one that Samuel sends for. And he says, there yet remains the youngest. And in the Hebrew language, the word for youngest can also mean the smallest. And I think it's possibly intentional that we're meant to wonder which one it is. Is it the smallest, the youngest, or is it both? But there seems to be a play on that idea. Versus the height of Eliab, we have the youngest or the smallest, and that's the one that Samuel calls. And so this son is brought in, and he's also described in terms of appearance. Notice this. He is ruddy or red-cheeked, possibly, and has beautiful eyes and was handsome. Now, what's interesting about that description in light of what we've just seen God say about Eliab?
Man looks at the outward appearance.
Yeah, man. Yeah. So man looks at the outward appearance. And so that leads to think we should discount physical appearance. But it still takes the time in the text to mention that David has a desirable appearance. And so is this an inconsistency then? Is he still too much like Saul? One commentator that we've used a few times in this class has an interesting comment about this. I'm just throwing this out for your consideration. Just as Eliab, like Saul, is not to be chosen simply because he looks like a king, David is not to be dismissed because he looks attractive either. See the point? Godly leaders' aptness for leadership functions on an entirely different basis. So just as looks are not qualifying, they're not disqualifying either. The characteristic that God cares about is something entirely separate from that. Okay? I think there's something to that. Perhaps there's another way we could describe this connection here. But David, it does say, is handsome. He has a desirable appearance, and we're going to see people attracted to David in various ways, probably not least because of his attractiveness. Okay, so this is the one that God chooses, the youngest, the least, David. And it said, I should have noticed that last point. The Spirit of the Lord, it says, rushes upon David from that day forward. Who's the only other person that we've seen having the Spirit of the Lord rush upon them? So far, it's been Saul. It's happened a couple times, right after he was anointed and the signs came to pass. And then again, when the Ammonites were threatening, and then the Spirit of the Lord comes upon him there again. But now it's come upon David in verse 13, and then it seems almost simultaneously, as we change scenes and we leave Bethlehem and go back to Saul, the Spirit of the Lord departs from Saul, almost as though the Spirit of the Lord can only rest upon one leader of Israel at a time. And instead, what does Saul have in the place of the Spirit of the Lord? Yeah, so your translation may say an evil spirit. This one says a harmful spirit. It's a word that just means bad, and that could mean bad in the sense of evil, or it could mean one in the sense of unpleasant. So God removes his presence, his positive presence from Saul, and instead there's this other presence that is allowed to enter Saul. And we're going to see what this is going to do to Saul over the course of the next several chapters. But as you can expect, if it's something called a harmful spirit from the Lord, it's not going to be that pleasant. And the servants pick up on this. There's something troubling Saul. He's not himself. And they suggest something that might alleviate his suffering. What do they suggest?
Music therapy.
Music therapy, exactly. Music therapy, they intuitively sense that that would be helpful to Saul. And it's not entirely clear why, but this is something that people would have used in the ancient world to try to get relief from emotional, psychological distress, perhaps. Whether we think of this as something like demon possession, it's not entirely clear what this is, or what we would now call depression, something of that nature. His servants sense that this would be helpful, and so Saul says, "Provide." It literally says, "See or look out for me a man who can play well and bring him to me." So here again, the theme of sight comes into play. Just as in English, vision and provision are related, I mean, the original language here, the idea of providing and looking are related as well. So we've had the idea that God sees David in a unique way, and now Saul wants his servants to go and see who can help him. And one of his young men answers, "I have seen someone who you exactly who you would like." And it's not just because he's a good musician. What else does he say about David? He's a warrior. That's really interesting because we haven't seen David engaged in any warlike activities. What is the only occupation of David that we know about so far? He's a shepherd. But as we'll learn in the next chapter, even being a shepherd has some similarities of being a warrior, right? There are threats you have to deal with as a shepherd, and David will describe some of those to Saul eventually. But noticeably, the last thing that this servant of Saul knows about David is that the Lord is with him. So David already has a reputation, apparently. The Lord is with him. And just like at the beginning of Saul's story, when Saul doesn't really seem to know what's going on in Israel, he doesn't know where the man of God lives, but his young man, his servant, knows something. Here again, Saul doesn't really know who it is that can help him, but one of his servants knows. That's just an interesting comparison to something earlier in the story. And so Saul sends to Jesse, he says, "I want your son David to come and serve me." And Saul loves David. David is just what he needed. He plays the music that relieves Saul's suffering, at least temporarily. But not only that, he's a mighty warrior, just as described. He is the total package. And so, in fact, Saul quickly elevates him to a very trusted position of armor bearer. That's not a position you give to someone that you don't trust a whole lot. Somebody who's supposed to have your back. Of course, Saul doesn't know at this point that the Spirit of the Lord has departed from him and been given to David. So David has been brought into the confidence of the man whom he is supposed to replace. So whenever this harmful spirit from God comes upon Saul, David is able to refresh his spirit, and this harmful spirit will leave Saul for the moment. Any comments about what we've covered so far in chapter 16? So again, the theme of sight is important for this chapter. God admonishes Samuel about his lack of sight, and here, again, we see that Saul is not quite able to see who it is that he needs, but others have to tell him, have to show him who he needs, and that turns out to be David. So chapter 17 is one of the more well-known texts, not just in 1 Samuel, but in the entire Old Testament. It's the story of David and Goliath. And because it's so well-known, and also because it's nearly 60 verses, we're going to have to give it short shrift this evening, unfortunately. But it's a great story, and it really continues a lot of the themes that we've been building up to. And so we're going to just look at a few things from this chapter. But remember that in chapter 14, it said that Saul had success over his enemies in a military sense. He routed his enemies, and that included the Philistines. But even right after it said that there was hard fighting against the Philistines all the days of Saul. And we're going to see this popping up time and time again, that as much success as he has, it seems like there's For every army of the Philistines he defeats, another one takes its place, and it's even bigger and stronger than the last. And that's the case here, not just in terms of the army, but in terms of their champion, Goliath. So Goliath is this new threat that is facing the Israelites as they do battle with the Philistines. And I want you to notice the description of Goliath in verses 4 through 7. It's the longest description, physical description of anyone in the book of First Samuel. And what's the point of the entire description? If you had to just boil it down to a couple words, what would you say about Goliath? Larger than life, right? Every single thing about it. It's either he's big or he's heavy, or the things that he carries are heavy. He's someone who seems too big to be allowed. The descriptions are incredible. The weight of the things that he carried alone should have been impossibly large. And so it's not just his appearance, it's his attitude and his speech to Israel. He challenges someone to single combat. He defies the armies of Israel. And he says, choose a man for yourselves. So again, the language of choice comes into play. Who is, at least originally, the chosen of Israel who should meet Saul, who should meet Goliath in combat? I just gave the answer away. It's Saul, of course, right? He's the choice man of Israel. And also, Saul is the only other person so far in the book who's described as big, head and shoulders above the people. So you would expect that the man to go out and meet this giant threat would be Israel's giant, Saul. But what does it say about Saul's attitude toward Goliath? He's just like the people. He's dismayed. He's afraid. Saul can no longer hide behind the weapons anymore. That's his modus operandi, I guess, but he can't do it anymore. He's being called out to meet this threat, and he can't. He's shrinking back from it. So David comes on the scene. David apparently has been going back and forth from serving Saul and serving his father as a shepherd. And on one of these trips back to Saul, Jesse wants David to send some provisions to his brothers and also to bring back a report and bring news of his other sons. Notice who's at the battle and who's not. Saul hasn't brought David to the battle, but he's brought David's three biggest brothers, his oldest brothers. You remember the description way back in chapter 14. Whenever Saul would see a big, impressive man in Israel, he would immediately conscript him and add him to his staff, because that's what Saul cares about, size. And so David's three biggest brothers have been taken. But David is the smallest, and even though he's Saul's armor-bearer, has apparently not been selected to meet this big threat because he's not big enough. Saul's got the big guys, Eliab and the other two oldest of David's brothers. So David approaches, and he hears this challenge that's been issued for many days by Goliath. Nobody has yet been courageous enough to accept this challenge, and so the armies are kind of at a stalemate, just facing each other for a long time. But David now hears the challenge of Goliath, and he is relatively unimpressed. What does David think about this challenge of Goliath? What does he think of Goliath? Doesn't think too much about him. He calls him this uncircumcised Philistine. Has anyone else in the book of 1 Samuel used that language of the giant Philistine threat? These uncircumcised Philistines? Does that ring any bells? Jonathan, back in chapter 14. Remember, Jonathan took his armor bearer and it went and attacked an entire garrison of the Philistines. And what Jonathan said was, let's go up to these uncircumcised Philistines, for it may be that the Lord will work a great victory, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few. That was almost a foreshadowing of what we're about to see here in chapter 17. Jonathan was previewing what's possible when you allow God to fight your battles. David's unimpressed, and he doesn't say, as Goliath does, that Goliath is defying the army of Israel. He interprets what Goliath says as defying the armies of God. He sees the theological conflict, not just the military conflict. He said there is a battle for who's the true God going on here, and it's not the Philistines' God. It's not Goliath's God. It's our God, and that's who Goliath has defied. He thinks he's big, but he has defied something much bigger than him. So notice that David is the only one who seems to really understand the bigger implications of what's happening. So Eliab hears David asking questions. What's this Philistine saying? What's the reward going to be? I mean, David does ask, what's the reward going to be? What is Saul offered? And Eliab hears him asking all these questions, and he gets angry. Why do you think Eliab might be angry with David? Jerry?
Well, if it's like, if he heard the same thing his second brother did, is that you are rejected.
Yeah.
And it reminds me a lot of Joseph's brothers. And Joseph's, oftentimes a younger brother's chosen. Even Moses' two older siblings challenged him.
Mm-hmm.
And she got leprosy. But, you know, like, how dare my youngest brother? And I was rejected.
Great. So if you didn't get to hear that, there's a theme in the Old Testament of the younger brother surprisingly being chosen over the older brothers. And that often creates resentment and jealousy among older brothers because they have been rejected from the special task or the special place. We see this in Genesis multiple times, a younger brother being chosen above his older brothers, such as Joseph, for instance. And that seems to be what's going on here. Eliab has already heard from the prophet that he is not the anointed. He has been rejected, and his younger brother has been put in his place. So there's probably already some jealousy there, some resentment. And now he hears David trying to work his way to the front of the army, possibly to do something, and he doesn't want to see his brother in the limelight, possibly. It's a bit of speculation, but I think there's good reason to think that's what's going on. He says, I see your presumption and the evil of your heart. Notice that Eliab has dared to use heart language here. The evil of your heart. David sort of fights with him like brothers fight. What have I done? I just asked a question. That sounds exactly like sibling talk. And then David is summoned to Saul because Saul hears that David's asking questions. And Saul also, the other giant man here, he's big like Eliab too, and he describes this battle in physical terms. David, it is not possible for you to do anything here. You are not able. You're not big enough. You don't have the right equipment. You don't have the right training. He's been a warrior from his youth. Then David gives Saul a speech of his own. He says, you know, being a shepherd isn't just a walk in the park. I've had to wrestle bears and lions, and God's delivered me from those threats, and God can deliver me from this one. This is just the latest threat. And he said, the Philistine's no different than those other animals. And he says, the Lord is going to do this. I'm not going to do this. The Lord is going to do this. He'll deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. Saul is willing to give it a try, but on his terms. Notice the terms under which Saul initially is going to let David go into battle against the Philistine. He's going to clothe David with his armor. He's going to make David into his image. That's the only terms of battle that Saul apparently understands. And David puts on Saul's armor, but it doesn't work. That's just not who David is. It's not going to work, and he has to take it off. And so he takes his weapons. He goes into battle on his terms. All he takes is a sling. Interestingly, what tribe was known primarily for using slings? Anybody know from Judges?
Benjamin.
The Benjamites. That was supposed to be Saul's weapon. But Saul relies on the spear. It's the spear that's constantly in Saul's hand in this book. It's just kind of an interesting contrast there. David, in effect, is doing what Saul is not willing to do in many ways. So the Philistine is similarly dismissive. All the giants in this chapter are dismissive of David. Eliab is dismissive of him. Saul is dismissive of him. And now Goliath as well. He curses David by his gods. So both Goliath and David at least understand that this is about who is the real God. The Philistine curses David by his gods, and then David says, I come to you in the name of the true God, the living God, in the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, and that's who you've defied. And God is going to show today to everyone here that the Lord doesn't save with sword or spear. The battle is the Lord's, and he will deliver you into my hand. We sing a song based on this, right? The battle belongs to the Lord. No weapon that's fashioned against us will stand. And it happens exactly as David says. He slings a stone into the forehead of the Philistine. He falls to the ground and is dead. David takes the sword of the Philistine. And I think there's great symbolic significance to that, right? He takes the weapon of the one who depended on that weapon and chops off the head of this giant. This one who was head and shoulders above the people is now headless. And that may, in fact, be a commentary not just on Goliath, but on Saul, who was also head and shoulders above the people. And so there's something really, really interesting that happens at the conclusion of this battle. Saul asks the same question three times. And it should be a weird question for Saul to ask. But what does he ask? Who is this guy? Whose son is he? Where does he come from? He has to ask it three times. Again, Saul doesn't see. He doesn't recognize. You know, I mean, he may know who David is, but after he sees David knock down a giant like Goliath, he says, who is this guy? He can only see things on the surface. And on the surface, there's just a little guy knocking down a big guy. And in Saul's calculations, that shouldn't work. That doesn't work in material terms. That's impossible. And his categories are being blown up here by David. And so David has to, in effect, reintroduce himself to Saul. Well, that was a lightning-fast summary of chapter 17, but I would love to hear any comments or questions, anything that we should pay attention to here.
You know, I did think about one thing, at least with a human can reason. Mm-hmm. And I think when Saul heard that a young person killed a bear and a lion who has no reason, when the bear comes after you, you can't plead to him and say, stop, don't do this. They just come. So I think when he heard that, then he knew there was something different.
He does at least allow David to proceed at that point, doesn't he? So it's like he has an inkling that there's something special about David, but he still doesn't understand the full implications of who David is and on what terms David fights his battles. Saul still apparently thinks he can kind of control David, but David serves God more than he serves Saul. Yeah, that's a great point. Anything else? Yes, Alicia. Right. Some people have argued that, in fact, chronologically, maybe 17 could have come before 16. So not everything in the books of Samuel are told in sequence. There's several chapters at the end of 2 Samuel that are told out of sequence for thematic reasons, right? To tell the story in a certain way, to make a certain point. So that's certainly possible. And the form of the story as we have it now, though, this takes place after. And so I think that creates a nice way of pointing out that Saul really doesn't see the way that he needs to. Even people who are in front of him, he doesn't really understand who they are, much as Samuel had trouble recognizing that same point. But that's a great observation. Anything else? Great. Good comments. All right, let's move into chapter 18. And the chapter break is unfortunate here because this really does follow right upon this defeat of Goliath. At the defeat of Goliath, there is somebody who becomes attached to David. And if you were paying attention to what Dad was saying to the kids, you should already know who this is. This is Jonathan. This is somebody whose soul becomes knit to David. And why might Jonathan's soul become knit to David's soul based on what we know about these two men?
They're at least pretty brave.
They both showed the similar bravery. And their victories were very similar, weren't they? John, did you have a point? That's well put. Yeah. So there's heart language that's used of both of them in their respective chapters, and their hearts mirror in some sense the heart of their God. They have a connection to God that perhaps Saul does not have. So Saul is also attached to David, but he's attached to him in a different way. He drafts David in turn, just like he has drafted every other big, impressive soldier that Israel has. That's still the terms on which Saul is attached to David for what he can do for him. But that's not the reason Jonathan is attached to David. In fact, it's quite the opposite, because what does Jonathan do for David at this point? It's really quite remarkable. He gives him all of his stuff, everything that would have been a symbol of Jonathan's status as prince, as the heir apparent. He gives to David his robe, his weapons, his armor. And notice, David has no trouble accepting Jonathan's armor. Whose armor can he not accept, though? He can't accept Saul's. And again, I think there's a symbolic point there. David can't do battle on Saul's terms, but he can do battle on Jonathan's, because Jonathan doesn't rely on these things either. Jonathan, just like David, relies on the Lord and understands the battle is the Lord's, because they have that heart connection to God, as John was talking about just a moment ago. Okay, so the love that Jonathan has for David is going to be echoed by the love that other people have for David. Throughout chapter 18 and the beginning of chapter 19, several other people will be said to love David. David is one who is apparently instantly lovable, but it's not just because of the appearance. It also is because of this connection to God that David seems to have. It's apparent to people that this is true of David. And he has great success in everything that Saul asks him to do, mostly in military terms. David has great success. And so Saul is reaping the benefits of David's success, but Saul begins to grow jealous because the people are noticing David. And even when the people come out to meet King Saul, like in verse 6, there's in their songs that are meant to praise both Saul and David, all Saul can hear is that David is getting more credit than he is. So even in a parade that was meant for him, Saul goes away jealous. Notice, who did they come out to meet? It doesn't say to meet Saul and David. They came out to meet Saul. That was a parade for him. It was his victory over Goliath and the Philistines. He's the king, after all. But when he hears the people singing about Saul slaying his thousands, great compliment for a warrior king, and David his 10,000s, all he hears is, they gave David more than they gave to me. What else can he have but the kingdom? And so it says that Saul eyed David from this day on. So he eyes him, but he really doesn't see him. He doesn't see what he really is. He can't perceive who David is and his connection with God. And in fact, his jealousy turns to fear, and he begins to look for opportunities to harm David. As successful as David is as Saul's servant, and as much good as he does for Saul, he searches for ways to harm David. What does he do in verse 11 that should really shock us? He tries to spear him. He tries to pin him to the wall. And again, remember, the spear is Saul's weapon of choice. We'll see that several times throughout the narrative. And this is not going to be the first time that he tries to do this. David escapes and continues to serve Saul, even after that, and is greatly successful. But Saul is just more and more afraid, because even now, Saul begins to understand God is with him in a special way. And perhaps Saul begins to be jealous of that as well. Okay, so now Saul begins to scheme. His next scheme involves his own daughters. Saul is going to be willing to use his own family to accomplish his political and military ends. He's already been willing to do this in chapter 14 by putting his own son to death as a result of a rash vow. Remember that? And now he's going to use his own daughters, Merab and Michal, to try to achieve some political end, namely getting rid of David. And how is he to plan to use his daughters to get rid of David? Just saying it like that already sounds like a bad idea, but what's the actual plan?
To win the daughters who have survived
the Philistines. Yeah. Right. So to win the girl, you have to go beat the bad guy. And if he gives him enough dangerous assignments, maybe one day he won't come home. Right? So at first he's going to give him the firstborn daughter. That girl ends up getting married off. So he offers the second one. And instead of the second one, Michal, that she loves David. And Saul hears about this, and he's even willing to use his daughter's emotional investment in David for his own ends. He's really scheming at this point, trying to play people off one another. And so he gives an impossible assignment to David. If you kill 100 Philistines and bring back some pretty gruesome proof of it, you can be my son-in-law. David's up to the task. How many does he bring back? 200. Saul has no choice. He'll lose face if he doesn't go through with his promise. So he has to give his own daughter to David, which he never thought he'd have to do. And so now, not only is David still out there, but David is now in the royal family and enjoys all the privileges of that. And Saul is terrified of him. He's gaining more and more power. Saul is feeling like he has less and less power. And so it says, notice the language here. Saul was David's enemy continually. It doesn't say it the other way around. It doesn't say David was Saul's enemy, because he's not. David is still serving Saul faithfully, because David understands that Saul is what? He's the Lord's anointed. And we're going to actually see that come out in tomorrow's lesson. So Saul is David's enemy, but it doesn't go both ways. David is still loyal to Saul. Okay, as we move into chapter 19 now, David's continuing to have success over the Philistines, even more success, it says, than Saul's servants. And so Saul thinks he can use that detail, that David's beating out his other officials. And so he gets the other officials, including Jonathan, to try to kill David out of jealousy. He's showing you all up, guys. Let's get rid of him. But who's the one who spills the beans to David? It's Jonathan. I mean, obviously, his soul is knit to David. He's not going to do this to his close friend. And so he lets David in on his father's plan. And not only does he let David in so that David can escape temporarily, Jonathan intercedes with Saul. And what does he say to Saul to get Saul to change his mind? It's a fairly obvious point, but unfortunately, he has to make it to his father. Why should Saul not kill David? He hasn't sinned against you. He hasn't done anything to you. And in fact, not only has he not done anything negative, he's done all these positive things for you. He has won you great victories that you have gotten credit for, Saul. And if you harm David, you're harming yourself. Should have been the most obvious of points. But, I mean, this is pretty true to life, right? Sometimes when we get very resentful against someone, we don't understand that our desire to harm them is actually going to harm us even more than it's going to harm them. And so Saul has to be reminded of this fairly obvious point, and so he relents. But he doesn't just relent, he takes another oath. Now, we've already seen that Saul's not great with oaths, but he takes another one. He says, "As the Lord lives, David shall not be put to death." So Jonathan tells David this, so David comes back to court. Saul's made an oath before the Lord. Surely he won't break that, right? Well, we're going to see for the rest of the chapter how Saul breaks that oath. In chapter 19 and verse 8, there's war again. And yet again, David goes out and has great success against the Philistines. It just seems like there's wave upon wave upon wave of the Philistines, but David is up to the challenge every time. But in spite of that success, when Saul should have been most pleased with David, the harmful spirit comes upon him again. This mood or this influence comes upon Saul. And what does he try to do yet again? Tries to do that, to pin David to the wall with the spear. David again has to escape. And David seems to sense that it's not just enough for him to leave the court for a while. He's got to get out of Dodge. He's got to get away from Saul, because this is only going to get worse. It's happened more than once now. Saul is deteriorating mentally. And so he goes home to Michal. Michal senses that David is in grave danger. She apparently is very aware of what's happening. So what is Michael's plan to save David? Jonathan's already had to save David. Now it's Michael's turn. What's her plan? A decoy, yeah. And it's a weird decoy. It's a really weird decoy. I would think this would look very weird. But she takes an image. This would have been some sort of figurine, and that's kind of curious, because these, most of the time they show up in the Old Testament, they're associated with sort of household religion of national deities other than the Lord. Remember, the Lord doesn't allow graven images of himself. So it's a little curious that David's wife has this. Maybe it's not so curious that Saul's daughter has it, though. Maybe that's the answer to why this is in the house. Or maybe this is some trophy of David's victory over a Philistine or something. We just don't know. But Michal uses this object and lays it on the bed and makes a sort of a head of goat's hair and covers it up. So it kind of looks like a person sleeping. And this is apparently to buy David some time as he escapes out of the house under the cover of night. And then, as Michal predicted, Saul sends people to come kill David. And what is Michael's excuse at first? Yeah, he's sick. I mean, he probably looked pretty sick lying there. But eventually they figure out that's not David. That's something else. And David by this time has escaped. And so Michal doesn't have to suffer the wrath of Saul. She says, well, he threatened to kill me. So I had to go along with the plan. So Saul is deceived by someone close to him as a result of this irrational desire to put David to death. But I think it's significant that the object that is used to deceive Saul is something that he's already been warned about just a couple of chapters ago. Do you remember this famous speech of Samuel back in chapter 15? "Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to listen than the fat of rams. For rebellion," which is what Saul is being accused of, "is as the sin of divination, and presumption is as iniquity," and the word is translated in the ESV as idolatry, but it's the same word as this object that Michael is using to deceive Saul. So this is an object lesson that Saul is undermined by the thing that he is guilty of. Okay, so it's an example of someone who digs a ditch and then falls into it. This is what Saul has been subjected to now. Well, he doesn't stop there. He still wants to get to David. Who does David flee to at this point? Who is his safest option? Samuel. Samuel, the one who anointed him to be king. That makes sense, because he probably has some questions for Samuel. Why did you anoint me if it's going to result in my near-death experiences every other day? When I'm not fighting the Philistines who are trying to kill me, I have to go home to my boss who's trying to kill me. And so he flees to Samuel, perhaps, again, understandably. But Saul is even willing to go there to kill David, even to the place of the one who anointed him, even this respected prophet in Israel. And he sends messengers to go harm David or to take David. But what happens to the messengers? Something weird. The Spirit of God comes on them and they prophesy. Remember, this word for prophesy, we've explained, has sometimes a secondary sense of to sort of rave about like a madman, to go into an ecstatic state, to go out of your mind, which is apparently what some prophesying would have looked like in that time. And so the presence of the Lord is so palpable around this area where Samuel is apparently, that every time Saul sends people, the Spirit of God comes on them to thwart their plans, and they prophesy or rave about and are unable to complete their tasks. So finally, Saul comes, because his messengers aren't getting the job done. And not only does the Spirit of God come upon Saul again, but it comes upon him in a much stronger way, so that not only does he prophesy or rave about, what else does he do? He strips off his clothes, and he lies down naked all night there in Samuel's territory. That's weird. But think about what happened with Jonathan and David there at the beginning of chapter 18. What does Jonathan do to show his devotion to David? He takes off his clothes. He takes off his signs of royalty and debases himself to show his loyalty to David. He takes off all these trappings of royalty. And in effect, that's what Saul is being forced to do by God here, is he's being forced to take off his royal garments to show in a very powerful way that he has been rejected. Jonathan lays it down willingly. Saul lays it down unwillingly. And so this proverb about Saul is now brought up again, perhaps in a secondary or a new sense. Is Saul among the prophets? Now, before, in chapter 10, I think that had more of a positive spin to it. Is even Saul, who's just this guy from Benjamin, is he now among the prophets doing all these great things, prophesying in a positive way? Now it seems to be in a sort of sarcastic sense. Is Saul among the madmen, the ravers? Remember back in chapter 10, similarly, there was a group of prophets around, the Spirit of God rushes upon Saul, and he prophesies. It's a very similar situation, but the proverb seems to mean something different here. As one commentator puts it, perhaps these two occurrences of the proverb represent two different evaluations of Saul. On the first occasion, the prophets were not fit company for him. But on this occasion, now, he is not fit company for them. So we can see sort of the downfall of Saul over the course of these chapters. Another commentator puts it this way: Saul is too spiritual to succeed in killing David. After all, he prophesies, but not spiritual enough to succeed as king. So let's go back to our list. Are there reasons to be sympathetic towards Saul in spite of his failures? I think there are, and I think we've listed several that they're good reasons. But maybe based on these chapters, we can at least add one more. Saul is not always himself. Saul is not always acting on his own initiative. But that doesn't mean that we let him off the hook, right? Because I don't think the inspired author means for us to let him off the hook. One more quote that I think is helpful here. Saul is thereby held to be responsible for his actions, as we all are, but not blamed cheaply for things that he has little power to resist. And this gets back to the point that we made about Eli at the beginning of this week, that even those people who are under judgment from God or receive this rebuke from God doesn't mean that they have nothing positive to teach us. These are complex stories about complex people who, like us, have flaws and successes and virtues, and they're a complex mixture of all these things. Saul is someone upon whom the monarchy was thrust, and it has begun to destroy him. The power has gone to his head and into his heart, and he is not fit to handle this burden, and that's why God has sought someone else, a man after his own heart. And we're going to learn more about that other man in these coming chapters. So tomorrow's assignment, I want you to read, if you're going to be here, chapter 20, 22, 24, 26. Yes, even these chapters. It's not that odd. All right? Thank you all for your comments and questions.